We have sound. Good morning, everyone. And welcome to this session that is about deploying Hyper-V servers. We are going to cover generic Windows Server deployment too, since that is a part of this. If you think it's very crowded over here, I think there's a space over there, and maybe up there too. You can be very alone. My name is, of course, written, and I need my glasses to see, sorry. Like that. My name is Michael Nyström. I come from Sweden, which you most likely can hear on my accent. I do travel a lot. I do OS deployment, virtualization, and related Microsoft-based infrastructure, which means that I do everything for money, since I'm a consultant, a trainer, and a speaker. I'm also an MVP in setup and deployment, a member of the STEP program, an MCT. Fine. Done. There are multiple ways of deploying Hyper-V servers, and we are going to cover basically the way that I do it today using Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. We're going to cover answer files and task sequence, how they work. We're going to cover how to customize the light touch environment, so it will be something that works pretty much perfect for you. We're going to cover hardware detection, driver injection, pre and post configuration actions, how to make the server configured the way it should be. So before we start, Microsoft Deployment Toolkit is it's very simple. It's a roll of duct tape, to be honest. I mean, Microsoft has all these tools, right? They have the Windows Automated Installation Kit, the Wake Kit. They have the System Image Manager application to create unattended text XML files. They have Windows Deployment Server. They have a lot of things. But when you try to use all these components together, you will notice that there are pieces missing. Microsoft Deployment Toolkit is used to fulfill or replace those missing parts so you do have an end-to-end solution. It's one of those things that is not a product. It's a solution accelerator. And the difference is that products are made by young developers, and the solution accelerators are created by people that has been in the industry for a couple of years. Old guys that knows what actually works and doesn't work. If you're 20 and you're a developer, you don't really have seen the world at that time. So experience is not really what you have. There are different scenarios in Light Touch. One is, and the best thing is actually, it doesn't really require any infrastructure. And I like that. One of the reasons I do build solutions for deploying Hyper-V servers is to be able, of course, to automate the deployment of the servers. But it's also a part of something called disaster and recovery. When you do disaster and recovery, which means that you're standing in the middle of something that smokes, burns, and smells, you don't really have an infrastructure at that moment. And I would like to be able to rebuild my data center really, really fast with no requirements. Otherwise, it's going to be kind of funny. Well, you first need that, and then you need that, and then you need this, and then you... I think you recognize that problem. It's going to take for hours before you can begin doing what you really need to do. It does use simple technology like network shares and CDs and DVDs and USBs, and it can be used for different scenarios like refresh, upgrade, replace a new computer. And the focus here is going to be a new computer, because that's the scenario we do for servers mainly. And I would like to show a demo of this, but since I do have a friend here in the audience, which name is Johan Arvidmark, and he is a deployment expert too. He's not as good as me, of course, but he's still pretty decent on deployment. So Johan, please come up and do a demo of Light Touch for me.
Do I have a...
Yes, you have sound.
Sound, beautiful. I'm trying to do two things at a time here.
walk and talk?
Also, I try to. I'm a man. It's a different thing. I try to monitor the Twitter feed for this session. So just let me switch back to my demo laptop, which is, by the way, number two. Yours are number three.
Yeah. Number one is not in the room. Is Niehaus here?
He would be number one.
He would be number one in that case. I can't see him.
So on Twitter, of course, the official ticket tag and also this session tag. Whoops, 305.
Thank you.
If you have any questions throughout the session, feel free to post them here and we will try to answer them. I will try to answer them from here. And sometimes, if we're lucky, Michael will see them as well, and he will be able to answer them as well. If we cannot answer them during the session, we will answer them after the session. So if you have a question, feel free to post it, and we will monitor it from here. So I'm Johan. I'm a deployment geek, and I will demonstrate MDT Lite Touch for you. As Michael said, it's a very simple solution, but it's a very rich solution. I consider MDT Lite Touch to be a not only a deployment solution, but in fact a development framework for doing deployment. Because it's very open architecture. Most of it are VB scripts or HDA pages or things like that, open databases like SQL that I can use. So it's very easy to extend. Meaning, if you want a feature that is currently not in, or you want to modify something, you can easily do that because of its development framework. So feature-wise, MDT Lite Touch, which is a free component, is equally good as any third-party or commercial OS deployment software you can get. I can do the same thing with Lite Touch as I could with Config Manager, Altiris, and Acronis on all these different type of solutions. And you will not be alone using this either. There is about the update one, which is the latest release, 400,000 downloads. The previous version, the RTM, about 300,000 downloads. That's a lot of people out there using these solutions, meaning there is a lot of information out there on the internet to find about these solutions. How many of you are actually using MDT today? Like 7 people. All right. We will hope to double that at least by the end of this session. So, after installing Lite Touch on a file server, because that's all you need, a folder having stuff in it, you have the deployment workbench. So, it's basically the UI where you manage the content in the folders. So, as you can see here, I have actually created a few folders. They are called deployment shares. Wow. Trying to do this and this. I normally keep at least 2 folders. I use one when I create my reference image and for lab and test. And then I have a second one for my production images. But technically, you could have one, but it's nice to actually divide them into 2 separate environments. Because it's also very easy to hand off this to another team if you want to. Sometimes you have a global team creating the images, and then you have production copies throughout the enterprise on every site. But there is no way or no point in having this being replicated through your entire enterprise when it's actually only the production images that you need to replicate out. So how difficult would it be for me to hand over reference image creation to Mike? Well, I would have to copy that folder and I need to paste it on another machine. Could even be a workstation if I wanted to, but I recommend using a server. So, what you do is that you basically create a new deployment share by right-clicking here and do new. And when you have a share, you start to do 3 things. And the things you do are the following. One, you import setup files. And setup files could be operating systems, it could be applications, it could be drivers, it could be updates. Things that you want in your reference image. After doing that, you create a sequence. One or more. This sequence is the to-do list. When you start the deployment, this list of action will determine what happens during the deployment. And after doing that, you configure what is the rules, the settings for the deployment. They are by default stored in a text file. If you want, you can store that in a database too. This is it. And when you have done that, you basically right-click the deployment share and do update. Because what MDT will do then, it will create the Windows PE boot image for you. You can add that to your Pixie server or to a USB or to a normal CD. You start the server on it. It will connect back to the deployment share, read the settings, display a wizard for you, and start the deployment. So, in my scenario here, I have added a few applications in here into the applications node. Office, SQL 2008, Virtual Machine Manager, PowerShell module, things that are good to have. In the operating systems, I have imported two different reference images. One would be normal enterprise, Server 2008 R2, and one is the data center core version of the image. So I simply right-clicked the OS here, and I did import, and I selected a WIM file that I have created previously. If I need any drivers, I will go ahead and import them here. So here is my drivers for this specific machine, HP and a specific blade, old 460G1. And I have now also added a few packages in here because when deploying Hyper-V hosts, RTM, there are, well, a few hotfixes that you actually need for those hosts unless you're running SP1, and Michael will cover that in greater detail later. So I'm simply going into this UI, right-clicking the different nodes, importing stuff to it. And after adding these components, this is where I create my sequences. So I have a few sequences here. For example, a few different base servers that I normally deploy. So I have a few sequences that deploy, you know, basic server configurations that we have in our data center. So looking at, for example, the base image here, if I look in the sequence, well, it's loading a 32K XML file, so it will take a little while for it. It's massive.
Yeah, it's intense data reading and writing.
So shorthand story, when we start a deployment, this is what happens. This is the list of things MDT will do. And you can add stuff to this. You can remove, you can change. You can customize the entire flow. So for example, in the very beginning, it will, for example, format and partition the drives. So there is a step that will, you know, format the drive, and you can change and configure how big you want the drive to be. Here we have added a custom action that will online a SAN for us, a LUN in the SAN. And then I will go ahead and format and create that second data partition as well. Again, I simply just copied and pasted this action, and I changed the disk number to 1, and now I can format that one. And this one is just a disk bot script making removing the read-only attribute of the volume. Later, this sequence will install the operating system. In this case, applying this WIM file to disk 0 partition number 1. Later, it will, in this case, do some basic OS configuration, and Michael will cover that in great detail. Some hardware configs that we have. It will run Windows Update as many times as needed against a local WSUS server if you specify it. Otherwise, it will go directly to Microsoft Update. Don't do that. Have a local server. One, it always works. Two, you can actually approve what patches that goes into the WIM or the deployment. Then it will install any applications I have selected, and then it runs Windows Update again in the very event I installed something like SQL that may have an update for it. And in the very end, we have a special custom action that this is actually Michael who wrote this in the beginning. The SQL sends us an email. saying that the server deployment is done, and it actually attaches the log files from the deployment to that email as well. So, but pretty cool stuff. So I create the sequence, and then, as you can see here, in my settings, currently, I only have the default settings. So let me show what happens when I just use the default settings. So the only thing I have done right now is actually the first two steps. I have imported the files, and I have created the sequence. So let me go to a client here. Da-da-da-da. Server 1. Go to a clean snapshot. Capture my media. The boot image I was talking about before. And I will boot on it. So now I'm loading Windows PE. And as I said before, I can add this to my Pixie server, or I can add that as an ISO, and I can even mount that on a remote card or whatever you're using for your servers.
And a choice between doing Pixie Booth and or ISO USB depends on the price tag for runners in the data center.
Yeah.
If they are extremely cheap, it's easier to have them just running around with USBs, right?
I prefer Pixie still, but sometimes you have policies that says, no, you cannot use Pixie. All right, fine, I'll use my ISO then.
So you also heard that the DHCP protocol is very dangerous and unsecure,
yeah.
So you can't use that in a data center.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fixed IP addresses is much more secure.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
So.
I also heard that.
Whoop. So here is my Windows PE boot image right now. And as you can see, I can now see on the client the available sequences that I have. And I don't know if you can see this. Let me zoom it in for you. I have added a special thing down here. Not included in MDT by default. But in the Dart package, there is a remote connection tool now in version 7. So I can actually, if I need to, I can remote into this WinP boot image if I need to do something and I don't want to run around in the console in the data center. I'd rather do it from my workstation. So this is something that will be added in the next release of MDT, but it's currently available. I have an article on my blog. There are links later in the slide deck, so you can add it as well. It's just an executable file.
So here's the thing. Many data centers do have, like, ILO and things like that.
Yeah.
The issue I have is that many data centers do have one brand, one vendor, but are changing into another. Yeah, we always Dell. But we are shifting into HP. So everybody has at least two different technologies. Using this method, we have the same technology to access the machine, as long as we install Windows.
It's a quite neat way to be able to access WinPE from remote. But I will select the sequence. I will select my base image that I show you. And now I'm showing you the default wizard behavior. So I need to specify a server name, server 1. I need to specify to join a domain or a work group, and I can also specify if I want to join a specific OU. I can do that. Language settings, time zone, any applications I want to have. Yes, please, SQL Express, thank you. Do I want to capture an image? No, it's a normal deployment. Do I want BitLocker? No, not this time.
Okay.
And off I go. And it's now, starting the deployment, executing that sequence. However, let me kill this one. And just change the rule on the server. So I will go back to my server. And I will update the text file. So I will take a sample I have, put it back into the production. Now it looks a little bit different. The answers that I provided in the wizard, I have now provided on the server in this text file. So I've simply decided to skip a bunch of the screens. I will join it to a domain up here, specifying credentials and such to join it to the domain. So the only thing I did was changing a text file on the server. So let me go back to my client again, capture the media again. And start the deployment one more time. And by the way, one of the most common issues that we see customers run into is the boot image, of course, needs drivers as well, but it only needs basically NIC and storage. If you import those drivers into the workbench, they will actually be added to the boot media too when you do the update or the deployment share. So now I'm starting WinP one more time. But now, since I changed the rule on my server, the wizard will behave a little bit differently. So it's a Microsoft moment. It's on its way.
Well, like my girlfriend says, it's thinking.
It's thinking.
It's calculating.
So I still need to select the sequence. So I will select my base image again. Computer name, server 1, applications, done. If I wanted, could I have automated these three additional screens as well? Sure. It's up to you to decide. The word light touch has nothing to do with light touch. MDT light touch can be zero touch. It can be as automated as you would like it to be. Some customers, they prefer to have it automated the full way. They have a database where they store all the applications requirements, the settings, it's all there, central. So when they deploy a specific server with a specific MAC address, it's fully automated. And some customers, they like to actually have a small front end popping up. They select a few things and then go. It's up to you guys. So by that, I will leave it back to Mr. PowerPoint.
Thank you so much for that comment. Thank you for the demo. Good time. You know this stuff. Amazing. So, John was talking about customizations, and there are reasons to customize. One of the reasons we need to customize is that information needs to be injected somewhere when you do an installation. You need to make choices. And the less choices you make, the more accurate the installation will be. Choices like application, drivers, settings, all kinds of things. We also need to, I would like to, have other things happening for me. For instance, if I set up a Hyper-V cluster, one of the requirements is that we use the same firmware, same driver, same settings on all the machines in the same cluster. Otherwise, the cluster wizard is not going to be friendly. It's going to be slightly angry and say, hey, you're using the wrong firmware in that machine. So can I modify this to be able to do firmware updates? Yes, of course, we can do that. Add applications and things like that. We also might need configure BIOS and arrays and things like that. So how can you tweak this? In many different ways. And I would like to show you that. This is a desktop. And here is a task sequence. Now let's see what we can do. Things we can do is, for instance, the hardware configuration. Here you can see I have two blocks, one for HP and one for Dell. There are different applications that needs to be installed in Dell servers and HP servers. I don't like to select those applications. I would like the right application to be installed in the right type of hardware. And I refuse to have multiple images because that's what we see at customer today. They have a library with hundreds of different images, one image for each kind of hardware. It becomes an image factory. It's ridiculous. You need one. image, not more than one. So how can I specify that if this is an HP machine, I would like to install the support pack for that machine, and I would also like to install the HP firmware DVD to make sure it's going to have the right firmware and the right drivers? Well, it's pretty easy, actually. Here, I can set condition. I specify if the task sequence variable is equals to Proliant BL460CG1. In that case, run this block of configuration. And if it's a 465 and so on and so on. If it happens to be a PowerEdge server and it happens to be the following model, it's going to run that block instead, which means that in one sequence we can have the different hardware settings and configurations. Now, for those of you that have installed support pack, you also know that you might need SNMP to be installed before that, otherwise it will fail. And of course, in the base OS configuration, we do install SNMP. Now, you can install SNMP in different ways. The problem is that just by adding SNMP, which works, well, SNMP doesn't really get configured in the right way. So if I do open the HP tools on that machine, it will never really see the hardware configuration because you also need to configure SNMP. So instead of just adding SNMP, we create a VB script that adds SNMP, configures SNMP, restarts the SNMP services so that everything is done. Now, I've been doing server deployment for, I think, too many years at this time, and I just hate the fact when I ask one of my server guys where I used to work, is the server done? And the answer always was, almost. What do you mean, almost? There's just a couple of things I need to fix manually. So how long will that take? I'm not sure. A day, a week, or a month. And that is wasting money. Buying hardware, can't use it. Someone is almost done. And that's why I started to automate everything like this. So when the machine is installed, it's done, and I don't need to have a technician answering almost every time I ask. We do other things too. You can't really see this here, but we also verify that the BIOS and the firmware is correct and upgrade that too. So how does this kind of script look like? Well, it's not that hard. CTI, SNMP, maybe. Oh, there you go. That way you can also see something. It's a bunch of generic settings. These are pre-manufactured configuration files that is included in MDT. You don't need to write them from scratch. The only thing you need to do is to find this section in this VB script. It says function. And here I can do things. What do we do? Well, easy. I like log files. Log files give me the ability to track what's happening. Otherwise, we have a failed component, and I don't know why. So we log. Then we write in the registry. Then we verify that the service is running, and if it's not running, we're going to restart the service, and so on and so on and so on, which is pretty nice and simple. Then I do have a VB script here. So how do I get the VB script into MDT? Well, that's not even close to complicated. We take this file package, we go to my desktop on this machine and I paste it in. And then we go to applications. Since this is not really an application, it's more of a configuration, right? I'm just configuring SNMP. Well, then it's going to be an application, but I'm going to call this an application with source file, but I'm going to call it config SNMP. And I'm going to point to the folder where it is. And then I'm going to say sysscript. And since I can't remember the file name for it, because I'm old, I'm going to do a copy and paste. Did I type C-script? C-script. And now I do have an application, which means that I can open up my task sequence. And instead of this bogus that I had before, I can actually point this to a single application. So application is not really application. Application could be an application, but it could also be just a configuration that I can have different values set on or rules and say this should only run if otherwise not, blah, 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 and stuff like that. So how do you install the support pack? Well, this is also an application, but there's two ways of the support pack. One of the problems with the support pack for HP is that there are different support packs for different versions of the operating system, but it's also different support packs depending on if it's a 32 or 64 or special models. So in some cases, you can't really use the latest one. It depends. And I would like to be as generic as possible. You don't need to do this, but this is the way we've done it in many years. So here's an application called HP Support Pack. But if I go in and check, you're going to see that I have two support packs. And, sorry. I have one called PSP 8.70 and one is called Support Pack. Now, is there anyone running HP servers in here? How often does the support pack comes out?
It's about
6 years or so. And then the third way. Yeah. So it happens on a regular basis. New support pack, right? So let's say that you have 6 or 7 different task sequences, right? Then you need to remember in what of these sequences do you have the support pack, because you installed a new support pack as an application, and then you need to go into all these sequences and say, well, instead of 8.60, please install 8.70, right?
There is the install license, so you can install.
Yeah, but that it works in some cases. Sorry, I should repeat the comment. There's a way to install source so you can update a catalog for the support packs. Right. What we do is this. This is the real application, which runs the HP sum slash s slash use web. If you don't want to use web, that's fine, but that's going to download the latest and the greatest from the web, right? And this is the standard application, right? Now I can set requirements and say, well, you know, this application only installs on the following operating system, blah, 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 blah. But this is actually the application I do install. So this is a bundle. This is not really an application at all because it doesn't run anything. Instead, it has a dependency, which means that in my sequences, I say run this bundle. And this bundle is something that you then can change. You get the point here? Which makes it's more of a connector. So then you can just modify the application settings, which transform to all the other settings in all the task sequences. And that makes it pretty much easier to handle, especially if you do Windows Server 2008. You have both the 32 and the 64-bit. You need to have the right one, select the right one, and so on and so on. So I have one support pack that goes for every operating system, every version, and it applies to all kind of hardware, and then we make decisions on which one to install. It wasn't intended to be this way. It's supposed to be used in another way, but this is the way we use it for. And that this works. Other things that is important. If you go down to the list, this will configure the server, install everything. It will also, of course, install all the different roles I need. In this case, it's installed SNMP services, and then it configures the SNMP services. Here we have all the hardware configuration, which is fine. And here we have the Hyper-V configuration. Well, of course, it installed Hyper-V. No questions asked about that. It's going to install Hyper-V and restart the machine. But that's not enough. I've been doing a lot of virtual machine management installations and deployment, and we have these Blade servers. And everybody has two network adapters, right? So they show up in DNS with two IP addresses. And then you're supposed to join this into the System Center Virtual Machine Manager, and then you start configuring network, which will disable one of the network adapters and turn it into a switch. The problem is that name resolution now starts to be jumpy. You lose connectivity, and about half of all the machines, you need to restart, clean up DNS, restart again, reboot, type in the fixed IP address. Everybody loses connectivity with each other. I prefer to configure my network before the machine joins the domain, before the machine joins into a virtual machine manager. The network and the switches should be correctly configured from the beginning. So how do you configure everything? Well, you can do this in VBScript. And if you try to do Hyper-V configuration using VBScript, you either don't have any hair left, or you're just insane, because that's a nightmare. Thank God someone did that for us. As you can look at Johan's hairstyle, he's been doing a lot of VBScript around Hyper-V. He doesn't have a hairstyle anymore. There's a PowerShell module from CodePlex you can download, which means that I do install .NET Framework on my host machines to install this PowerShell module, because that gives me PowerShell directly in the Hyper-V host. Now I can do script. Now I can create things and do things with it. It's also extremely convenient to have if you decide to run core server. If you log on to a core server, you're going to have a command prompt, right? How do you stop a virtual machine from the command prompt on the core server? Have you tried to stop all VMs? It doesn't work. You need to do that from another machine. Well, I've lost network connectivity and I can't do that. Should I push the power button? Maybe, maybe not. Using the PowerShell module for Hyper-V gives you a command line to stop, start, create, move, and do whatever you like from a text-based console. But it also gives me the opportunity to configure the network adapter. Now, this is also an application. This is just a download, and it's a batch file, and you install that, so that's not a trick. That's just a command line. So let's check those and see how they look like. So I go MDT production, and we go applications, and we go for the PowerShell module. Here's the, it's just a setup, right? You can actually ignore the two lines in the top, because they only need it when you do core server. If you're running GUI server, you don't need them. It just basically copy files to the program files root, nothing else. Okay, so what about the other one? Anybody try to disable a network adapter using VBScript? Did you succeed? Eventually? Took a while, right? Okay, so I was trying to do a VBScript on that. I mean, it works. But I think PowerShell in this case is so much easier. Applications. This is app, and this was actually one of my first PowerShell script ever. So it's very complicated. If we get rid of all the stuff we don't need, it's going to look like that. I import a PowerShell module, two arguments, name of the switch, and one what MAC address. And the only thing we do is get a network adapter filter based on MAC address, and then we create the external switch. So how do you make this happen in MDT? Well, this is just a script file, right? Well, don't save that. Let's check the application by itself. The application by itself just happens to run PowerShell. Of course. Format word wrap like that. PowerShell on execution policy unrestricted file, the name of the file, and then I have two parameters, VM switch name and VM MAC. So, where did these come from? Well, they didn't come from anything, they are invented, and you can see them here. So if I want to use my own properties to configure servers, I put them in the rule file. And guess what? Here you can see them. The VM MAC and VM switch name are properties. And the only thing I need to do is this. Here, you have the MAC address for a machine. And instead of doing the Johann way, which means that I fill in the blanks or the form when I install the machine, I specify the computer name, task sequence ID, don't ask for applications, and I specify what MAC address of my Hyper-V host should be the network switch. And I specify the name, which means that this is the configuration I have for a complete machine. Well, in that case, I need to, for every server I install, I need to document this, right? Before I install the server. Well, that's your choice. Either you document the server before you install the server, or you document the installation after you install the server, and that takes longer time. So I prefer to document it before, because then anybody can install the machine. Well, how do you figure out the MAC address from a server? Well, that's not tricky. If you go into ILO, for instance, it's just copy and paste. We still use this in our own data center because we don't have much more than less than 100 Hyper-V hosts, and 100 hosts and 100 server names in a text file is not that difficult to manage. But for most of my customers, we do use a database instead. They think it's easier, and you can connect a web interface to the database, which is pretty convenient. And as you can see, we extend this to set all the IP addresses and all the configurations. So when I deploy my Hyper-V host, it's done. It takes about 45 minutes, and everything is perfectly done. If I want to reinstall it, the only thing I need to do is move the VMs from that machine using whatever method I like, switch it into next Pixie boot, power on, oh, power off, power on, and 45 minutes, it's a new machine with exactly the same setting it had last time. Other things we do in the sequence, which is also possible, is of course this. Agent install and configuration. We need to install the System Center Version Machine Manager agent. No, we don't. We can use the VMM console and push out agents, right? But then we need to open firewalls, and we need to have the communication. I have installed a server. Can you please install the agent? Is there anyone that has a problem communicating with the backup team at your organization? Every time you install a server, you need to communicate with the backup team, right? How many days after you install the server is the backup in place? More than one? More than a week? I have these discussions with backup people. They say, yeah, I'm going to do that tomorrow. Didn't happen tomorrow. Will it happen tomorrow again? No, well, maybe. I'm not sure. Takes too long time. That is possible to fix from the server side. I prefer to have it in the machine from the beginning. SCOM, possible to do from the server side. DPM, Data Protection Manager Agent. Anybody try to install that from the DPM console? Did it work the first time? Let me guess, you were forced to modify the firewall rules. Yeah. And the basic firewall rules you need to modify is to allow all traffic from the DPM server to any port on any machine on the network. It's like, what? Yeah, you don't need to open every port, just the one between 1024 and 65,535. That's the only port you need to open. That's a Swiss cheese. That's crazy. But if you install the agent before, then you attach the agent and you don't need to open the firewall. That crazy. So we put all this in from the beginning, and I did have a customer ask me, do you really install these on every machine, even machines that are not supposed to be used by backup or managed by a System Center Version Machine Manager? And the answer is yes. Because if I do need a backup, the only thing I do is go into the DPM console, attach. And I can automate that too if I like too. It's possible at least. And these scripts are not fancy at all. In here, look like this. Here we are. Applications. Here's the VMM agent. Same script. Does a bit of logging in the beginning, sorry. And here's the actual script command. Since that is an MSI file, and we put it in the /i and /qb. The DPM agent is slightly different, not that big, but there's a difference here. The difference here is that you are forced to put in the name of the DPM server in the command line. Otherwise, you need to run, as you saw, I had a sample of the set DPM server to make the agent contact to the correct server. And then we, of course, run the Windows update and install everything, and the machine is done. I don't have to send email in this sequence. It's not that common. Happens to people who like. You can, of course, connect the database if you like to do that. It's not that hard to do. It's built into the product. So it's a SQL Server 2008 R2 or a SQL Server. It could be a local, it could be a central. We do have customers using that for different reasons. One is to have it as a repository. We can, of course, automate more things. I actually show you most of the automation from the beginning. But there is one thing that I really would like to show you, and my computer is on a 3, and that is patch mess. For anybody installing Hyper-V, Hyper-V patches. There's a very nice... Do I have internet on this? Nope, not on that cable. Do we have on this cable instead? Identifying. Oh, I love this. Not. Oh, there you go. Hopefully. There's the TechNet Wiki page that contains an updated list for all the Hyper-V patches you need. Well, if you go through this list, you're going to find a lot of patches. And most of these patches are very nice. You click on them, and you come to this nasty request page. Those patches will never be installed using Windows Server Update Services. It doesn't matter what you do. But you can request those patches, and you can download these patches, and then, of course, in your solution, the only thing you do is go into Packages, right-click Import OS Packages, point to the folder where you have the patches downloaded and unpacked, and then you just import the patch. And suddenly, next time you install a machine, that patch will be included in the image from the beginning. And there is usually this amount of patches that needs to go into a Hyper-V host that is also a virtual machine manager, a client or agent, and together with the cluster. There's a bunch of small patches. If we don't have them in, we're going to have the blue screens and the freezes and all kinds of things. And I don't really like to have that in a Hyper-V environment. And pretty much with that, we are done. And is there any questions around this topic, or is everything crystal clear? No questions whatsoever. There might be swag involved. That my friend and colleague, former friend and former colleague. Still a friend, not a colleague. We did a book, so I do have three books to deliver for people who have very nice questions that doesn't include shoe sizes, hairdressing, alcoholic beverages, and other things. Yes? That is correct. So the question is, I told you that I do it in a different way, but I didn't show you that. You're very picky. That entitles you for a book, though. Yes? You're going to get the book. I'm just going to switch to my machine. There it is. So here's the trick. If you check here, I have the opportunity to... first of all, I'd hide this because there's no point. And under details, I can specify that this only runs under the certain operating system. And here is a list of every operating system. So it's very simple. Yes. So I said one package. What I do is that I create one for 64 and one for 32, right? And then I set the rule on this one to go only for 64. Right, so this only goes for, you know, whatever, say 64, right? And in this one, dependencies means that I import both of them. Since they have different rule sets, I put everything in one bundle, then install the bundle, and the bundle will say, yes, I'm going to install these 10 applications, but it's only that application that will actually be installed. The other ones will be ignored. There are other things. We showed you about the make and model. I talked about vendors and drivers and stuff like that. There are some other things that could say, if you have that particular plug-and-play number, well, I can set a rule on that too. So if you discover the following plug-and-play ID, run this application. If you discover the following plug-and-play ID with the following version, then run this application instead. So it's we can ask basically anything. MBT contains, is it like 381 plus variables that we can use for deployment? I'd love to see. Ah, BG Info. Well, that's a good one. Do we have time? Still time. BG Info. Do I have BG Info here? Someone asked about BG Info here. Who is that? Came through Twitter. Yeah, there's a book. Let me pick that up. Can I do it here? I'm sure I have it in here, but I have it here. There you go. Let's connect back home. It's very nice to have a portable data center, but it's better to have a data center back home. Then you have all kinds of fun stuff running around. Please connect, thank you. Yeah, not going to do that. BG Info looks like this. And you're not supposed to see this. Where is my production? Applications. It looks like... Was it on the top? Yeah, there you go. Thank you. The comment was, it's in alphabetic order. Check. He can't write, but he can, you know, he can't read, but he can't write. It's very simple. The only thing we do is that we create a folder, we do an X copy down to the BG Info, and what I do is that I create a very simple link file, and I create a setting called default BGI. So by doing this, BG Info will be in, and it will constantly create a new background picture every time you log on. Question over there? One more question. I didn't hear you. Absolutely, it can be. The question was, can it be configured to do clustering, and can it be configured to do together with VMM? Was that a question? Yes, absolutely. The only thing we need to do is to add the cluster service, and then we need to either run the cluster service with cluster.exe as a command line to create the cluster. I normally don't do that because in most cases, the creation of the cluster itself the first time is a manual process anyway. But then adding all the nodes to the existing cluster and the maintenance of the cluster is automated. But it can be done, absolutely. I've done it a couple of times, but it's not so common. But you use the command line for cluster.exe to do that, which is pretty easy. So the only thing you need to do is you need to really add the cluster service, which is also possible, of course. If you go back to the sequence here, there are other things that you might want to add. Maybe you want to have multipath IO. Fine, throw that in too. Base OS install. Let's add multipath IO. Let's add failover cluster. It's not that hard. And this also works, of course, for core server. Now, multipath IO needs to be configured, but in most cases, it will automatically be configured while you do the first connection. So if you do use iSCSI, for instance, the command line for doing iSCSI connection is iSCSI CLI.exe, and it's not that hard to do. The only thing you need to do is a connection to the SAN, which automatically then will configure multipath IO the first time you reboot the machine. And if you have a fiber channel SAN, it will automatically connect to all the drives anyway, so that's pretty easy to do too. It's not that hard at all. It was a good question, though. I don't have any books. Anybody have more questions? Anybody learned anything? Or were you just sleeping this session through? I fell asleep. Okay, I'm sorry. I have to be more amusing next time or something like that. Nobody has any more questions? Well, you have questions. You're just afraid to ask them in public. Thank you so much for coming to this session. If you do have any other questions, please come up to us. Johan and I will be here and take your questions for at least half an hour or something like that. Thank you for coming.